This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. You are listening to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture. I'm Lee Chui Lin. Decolonization is not just transfer of political power, the lowering of one flag, the rise of another. It's a process of social cultural change where we learn to adapt, in that we find our own identity and find our own path through the world. How were Malaysia's politics, economy and society reconfigured post-independence? Has Malaysia truly united, and are we truly decolonized? Today we're exploring the process of decolonization with historian Professor Emeritus Tan Sri Datuk Khoo Kay Kim. Tan Sri, welcome to the show.
Morning.
Let's start right at the very beginning. What were the circumstances of your birth and your early upbringing?
Oh, I was born before World War II, in 1937 to be precise. And I have always been reminded that that was the year when the Sino-Japanese War began. That was in China. But I lived through the occupation. In fact, my family went into the jungle in Kampa to try to avoid meeting the Japanese. But unfortunately, it was in the Kampa jungle that the British put up a fight against the Japanese. And we were very fortunate to escape. Anyway, when the fighting ceased, we went back to the town. Kampa was, in fact, my maternal grandfather's town. So we were in his house. And there I met the Japanese soldiers, even as a small boy. And I used to watch them every morning doing physical exercises and so on. At that time, I grew to admire them. We went through the Japanese occupation quite all right, because there was always shortage of food, shortage of so many things. But many people may not realize that during the Japanese occupation, the Japanese allowed the amusement parks to go on. You see, in this country before World War II, the amusement parks had been introduced. And then every night, practically the whole town would be there enjoying themselves. And in fact, that was where I watched Chinese opera, Malay Bangsawan. And in fact, I learned my Malay language through watching Bangsawan. So we had a comparatively easy time. I mean, as a young little boy, I need not have to struggle. I didn't go to school because my father didn't send me to the Japanese school. But the Japanese made all the men plant tapioca. So whenever he went to the field to plant tapioca, I would follow him. Then came the trouble at the end of the war. The area near Anson, where I was one of the places where ethnic riots occurred. This was a fighting between the Chinese and the group of Malays called Banja. It started in Batu Pahat and it spread to various parts of the country. And then there was the communist movement. And my father used to come back to the house to tell my mother. So I used to listen. So I learned a lot about what was going on outside the house. Then the British came back and we were all so excited. We were told that the British soldiers were coming in. So we, as children, we ran to the roads to wait for them. You see? And when they came in, most of them were Indian soldiers. And they threw sweets for us to pick up. And I was very fortunate because by the end of 45, I had already been sent to a school. The British revived the schools very early. From the day I was in school, I was introduced to football. So I became very active for many, many years.
Considering that you lived through three different countries, British Malaya, Federation of Malaya, now Malaysia, growing up and going through those processes, how aware were you of all these kind of notions of national identity and nationhood? Because those are kind of three very different nations.
No, I was, in a sense, very lucky again because my father was a government servant. And government servants those days were given government quarters to stay in. So in the area where I was staying in, My neighbors were made up of various ethnic groups. There were Indians, there were Malays, there was even a Eurasian family. So, and then I went to a school which was, again, multi-ethnic. Tola Enzen at that time was very multi-ethnic. As a result, I don't have ethnic feelings when I grow up, which is why I'm convinced that it's very important to expose young people so that they learn about other cultures. Don't encourage conflict among them. And in my case, although I was exposed for a while because I was studying English in the morning and Chinese in the afternoon, and one of my Chinese teachers was from China. So he was instilling Chinese nationalism in us. But my father held me back. But I learned so much about what was happening in China. And then, as I told you, my father explained to me what was happening outside our homes in Malaya itself. In the end, I'm from day one very conscious of the fact that I was a Malayan. Of course, at that time, there was no Malaysian yet. And I have not changed to this day.
You mentioned, not having necessarily a lot of ethnic feelings. And that is something that's present today.
Yes.
But at the time, what were the forces that shaped society as it was lived? And, you know, as people went about their day, what were the things that kind of shaped their days?
In the outside world, as I said, my father, being a government servant, was not so exposed to such problems. But in the outside world, ethnic problems were already beginning to surface by the 1930s, mainly because most of the non-Malays were not citizens. So they themselves were torn between their country of origin, the countries of origin, and this country, and they didn't know where they were. Like, for example, in my case, my parents were different from me, you see. They were born in Penang, and Penang being a British crown colony, together with Malacca and Singapore, they were British subjects. But they got married in Perak, and I was born in Perak. But at that time, the non-Malays were stateless citizens. So I was a stateless citizen. But luckily, important changes occurred after World War II, and I was able to apply for federal citizenship by 1949 or so.
But did it mean that you grew up thinking of Malaya as home, or did it occur to you that since, you know, you, in a sense, you're a stateless citizen, that there is a possibility for another home somewhere else?
Ah, interesting question. Because my family was very much a Penang Peranakan family. So we were not so closely associated with China as many of the other Chinese. You see. Although, as I said, when I was studying Chinese, the teacher from China used to tell us a lot about China, and we were very fascinated. But we were so used to everything local. Take, for example, the food we used to eat. Penang, very famous for laksa, for char kway teow, and so on. Because of that, culturally, I was quite divorced from China.
If I'm not mistaken, you were 26 years old on September 16, 1963. Do you remember what you were doing, what it was like on the day that Malaysia as such came into being?
I was teaching. I went back to my, after I finished my degrees, I went back to my old school in Tola Enzen to teach, mainly because I wanted to be associated with sports. I was already very crazy of sports since school days. So I spent so much of my time coaching the school children in sports. And I was so happy when one of my boys was picked to represent Malaya in the Asian Games in 1962. But after coming back with a bronze medal, you see, unlike the athletes of today, whenever they come back with a medal, they are rewarded. My poor pupil, because he missed the fifth form exam because of this sports, when he came back with the bronze medal, he asked the headmaster for permission to repeat his fifth form, and the headmaster said no. And the poor boy was unemployed for 2 years because of that. And then I felt that it was pointless for me to continue teaching, and that's when I went back to the university to do my master's degree.
When it comes to Malaysia Day, was there any sort of singular iconic moment? You know, I mean, when we think of Merdeka, we think of yes. course, the Tunku's declarations. When it comes to Malaysia Day, I mean, it's only recently become sort of prominent because it became a public holiday. Suddenly people start thinking about it more. But yeah, in the case of Malaysia Day, was there any kind of iconic memory that comes up of that day?
People did not quite understand what it was. You see, even until today, the people of Sarawak, Sabah and the peninsula are not that close. You ask any peninsular Malaysian about people in Sabah and Sarawak, they will know. But at least in the case of the University of Malaya, in the early years, many of the students in Sabah and Sarawak used to study in the University of Malaya. But after some time, they had their own universities, and now we don't meet anymore. So, and many Malaysians don't realize that the term Malaysia was not used for the first time in 1963.
Oh, when did it come into common parlance?
It used to mean the Malay archipelago. And it was used occasionally in the newspapers, even as early as the 1900s. But in the mid-1930s, there was an American scholar called Rupert Emerson who came up with a book called Malaysia, A Study in Direct and Indirect Rule. So those who went through English schools and were introduced to history and geography had some idea of what Malaysia was all about. But those who did not go to English schools and those who did not study geography and history would have no idea. Even until today, many Malaysians have no idea that the term Malaysia meant the Malay archipelago.
At what point did Malayans start to refer to themselves, even in their own heads, as Malaysians?
Hardly. Because you remember that we used to celebrate Merdeka Day for a long time, even after 63. And then there were protests from Sabah and Sarawak because they said in 1957 we were still British colonies. So they did not cease to become British colonies until Malaysia was formed. And Malaysia was formed only in September 1963. So about a few years back, there was a compromise and it was decided to celebrate Malaysia Day. And then the first time it was held in Kuching, the celebration, so I was there together with a lot of the politicians. Since then, of course, we talk about Malaysia. But unless the young study history, one of my friends told me, for example, that one day he asked his son, he said, you know, this country became a nation state in 1957. What was it called? And the son said, Malaysia, which was wrong.
And you, as you mentioned, Malaysia became decolonized, I suppose, at different periods of time, technically only in 1963, but if we look at the peninsula in Borneo, it's different. And many have interpreted decolonization as the end of the era of colonization, the collapse of an empire. How is it defined? I mean, how would you define it? What is decolonization?
Decolonization is a term that was applied to many of the countries which had become British colonies, or in the case of Indonesia, a Dutch colony. Many people are not aware that in the case of Malaya, before World War II, the Malay states were never colonized. Only Penang, at one time, the Dinding District of Perak, Melaka and Singapore, known as the Straits Settlements. The Straits Settlements became a British Crown colony as early as 1867. But the Malay states were not. they were called protected Malay states. And they remained that way, although the British tried their very best to blend all the Malay states. They failed before World War II and decided to try to use force. In 1946, they introduced the Malayan Union, which practically turned the Malay states into British colonies. But because of the protests from the Malays, the British had to change that to the Federation of Malaya in 1948. And once more, the Federation of Malaya were like the Malay states before World War II. They were not British colonies, but British protectorates. So that the man who was governor of the Strait Settlements was called High Commissioner of the Protected Malay States. Very complicated, our history.
So how did those states and colonies exist side by side? I mean, what were the dynamics of power that existed at the time?
Oh, there was constant discussions and, in fact, debate. And the British themselves were trying to find the best way to solve these problems. There was a period when the British introduced what was called a decentralization policy. And then there was also a period when some of the British officials, private companies, British companies, when they had disputes with the Malay states, they attempted to sue the Malay rulers in British courts. There were three occasions when this happened, in the case of Kelantan, Pahang, and Johor. But in each case, and this is very important, in each case, the judge in Britain said, he is a sovereign ruler, we cannot touch him. That is sufficient proof that the British recognize the Malay states as sovereign states and not British colonies. But their role was to protect the states. And they did that, for example, during confrontation. The British sent soldiers to help Malaya against Indonesia.
That statement, I mean, that in some ways we were not a British colony as such, you know, has troubled some. There was an open letter written to you, I think, by Rachel Liao. Did you read it?
Yes.
Do you have a response to it?
I responded, but my son did not allow me to publish it because I was actually summoned by the police to give evidence. And I merely told the truth based on historical facts. For example, many people said that the communists were the ones who drove the British out of the country. The reverse is true. The British had already announced that they would withdraw from Malaya by the end of World War II. But when they came back in early September 1945, they found that the communists had practically taken control of the country. So they said they could not leave the country until they had defeated the communists. So began the emergency. The British brought troops from various places to confront the communists. And by 1954, it was very clear the communists had been beaten. And that's when they made preparations for Malaya to become a nation state.
I don't know if it's a fair statement or a fair question to ask. I mean, to say that even though we were not strictly colonized in that sense, it doesn't mean that we didn't have a colonial mindset of sorts. Is that fair?
I think the situation was more complicated than most people think. British influence was strong, no doubt, but people don't understand that Chinese influence was also very strong in this country. For example, Mandarin was already beginning to pick up by about 1913. And the first Chinese school to use Mandarin was Fun Yu in Johor. And then by the time the war had ended, the Chinese confrontation with the Japanese so influenced the people here that they were, in a sense, supporting the Nationalist Party. So they used to fly the Kuomintang flag. Very complicated. And in the case of the Indians too, one of their leaders came in 1943 and he initiated the Indian independence movement in this country. He trained the Indians, both men and women, so that they could march to India to fight the British. And it was this man, Chandra Bose, whose activities later influenced the formation of the Malayan Indian Congress. So it was very complicated. And those who were running the country tried their best to blend the people. But it wasn't that easy, you see.
With all these different influences going around at the time, when did that blending process finally start to take hold? I mean, of course, some could argue that till today we're not the most united nation, much as we would like to say we are. But at what point did people start to think about raising the Malaysian flag as opposed to the Kuomintang flag, or as opposed to looking for, you know, their own independence as such?
As they moved towards what I call the formation of the nation state, which was 31st August 1957. So we became a nation state. But even then, people are still very confused. In many government documents, when there is a column called Bangsa, we are expected to say Melayu, China, India, which is wrong. Bangsa means nationality. Doesn't mean ethnicity. Because our translation of the United Nations National Organization is Pertubuhan Bangsa Bangsa Bersatu, nation. See, the young people don't understand what is nation, what is ethnicity, what is constitution, what is member rule of law. Unless they understand these things, it will be very difficult. There will be confusion, unnecessary debates, and with the media these days running riot. I think it's very difficult unless the schools play a very big part in educating the young.
How have you seen the changing of what we would think of as our national identity through the years? I mean, in the first place, how did it form? And after that, how has it changed?
It has not really changed because, as I said, people are still emphasizing Malay Chinese Indians, whereas they should be talking about Malaysians. We have this slogan, One Malaysia. But if you ask the young people what is meant by One Malaysia, they don't know. See, One Malaysia is not a reference to the country, it's a reference to nationality. Education is very, very important. The world is becoming more and more influenced by legal thinking. So you cannot just use words as you like. Each word has a specific meaning, especially if you're talking about terminology. And unfortunately, the young have not been introduced to all these things. They spend so much time passing exams.
When it comes to looking at the influences that shaped Malaya and Malaysia, in the formation of a nation state, how much of those influences did we want to divest and how much did we want to include? And what was that process of deciding, or did we not decide? Was it kind of just handed down?
No, I think it's a very interesting question, because very few people realize that many of our leaders before World War II were already talking about the formation of a nation state. So if you look into our old newspapers, there were constant discussions. But all these have not been brought out. So then when the young study Malaysian history, they're not aware what their own leaders had said before World War II. They all think that everything began after the end of World War II. No. In fact, throughout the 30s, there were constant discussions. And to me, therefore, history is so important. See? And the young should be introduced to these things so that they would not be misled by naughty people who try to split the Malaysian population.
What were those negotiations like? I mean, when the leaders were discussing a nation state before external forces changed their plans, what would that country have looked like, or what were the beginnings of those discussions like?
We were very fortunate because before World War II, the country is not yet a country, but Malaya, as we used to call it, was so successful. Very few people realize this. That before World War II, Malaya was the richest state in the whole of the British Empire. So the people were living a very good life. Therefore, they had the time They were not involved in wars and fighting. So they had time to think about the future. And the leaders tried their best to bring the people together. Always warning the people that unless they came together, then the future would be very bleak. Our newspapers, and you know, at one time, we had English newspapers alone from Penang to Singapore, about 7 newspapers. They're all there, very well preserved in archives. And it takes only hard-working young scholars to go through all these things. Very interesting. I spend a lot of my time now, after I've retired, reading old newspapers.
Well, I suppose it might be a better read than our current set of newspapers in some ways.
Yes, definitely.
When we speak of the British Empire, I feel as if the thing that is often said is, or the thing that's often observed is the shrinking of it, of course, because there was a point in time where they were the largest empire.
Right.
Can an empire truly and totally disappear? What happens to its legacies when it starts to diminish?
I think Britain is the answer. Britain was so successful at one time. But economically, it had become more and more dependent on the United States. In the end, United States dictated terms. America was very, very fearful of the rise of communist influence. And the United States felt that the best way to check the spread of communism was to encourage all the young countries to become nation states. So Britain was told that it should withdraw from its empire. Otherwise, American would not buy products from England anymore, especially in the case of Malaya. America said, we will not buy your tin and rubber. And so that process started after the end of World War II.
There is a popular notion that the post-war British Empire was a sort of benevolent colonial master granting independence, but it also coincided at the point with an intense period of British military activity, suppressing anti-British nationalists and communist insurgents, as we talked about earlier. How is this image of a, you know, sort of benevolent post-war empire, you know, how is that reconciled with the violence of the emergency?
It differs from country to country. If you take the case of India, from day one, the Indians were fighting the British for independence. In the case of Malaya, there was no problem. In fact, when the British first came to Malaya and they wanted to take control of the country, they based their policy on their experience in India. So one of the British leaders in this country said, oh, we do not want the Malays to be like the Bengali Babu. And then they said, oh, in the case of Malaya, the rulers are very important. Without the rulers, Malay society will be a mob. So their policies at that time, before World War II, was to maintain Malay society as it was, and not let Malay society copy what was going on around. In the case of the Dutch in Indonesia, the situation was too complicated, and therefore fighting broke out between the Indonesians and the Dutch. So Malaya was actually an ideal country before World War II. If you look back into history, you'll find that unlike other people, we had a very nice time. Imagine when Malaya took part in the British Empire Games in 1950 at Auckland, our weightlifters emerged as the champion. And then more than that, emergency was declared in 1948. In early 1949, we became world champion in badminton.
There is a popular notion, I suppose, that independence was something that we fought for, you know, we wanted, we sought. Is it fairer to say that in some ways independence was something that was hoisted upon us in some ways because it was like, well, we're leaving now, you're independent now?
As I said, the British announced that they will withdraw before World War II itself. They announced that the moment the war ended, they would withdraw. So we did not have that kind of confrontation with the British as the Indians had with the British in India or the Filipinos had with the Americans, or the Dutch, the Indonesians with the Dutch. So Malaya was very, very different.
The Rukun Negara was written in response to the clarion call for unity after the racial riots of May 13th. Yes. You were part of the team that wrote the lines. How do you feel about that, about the Rukun Negara being, you know, part of something that you did?
Well, you see, it was an idea that was put forward by the late Tun Ghazali Shafi'i. He was influenced by what happened in Indonesia. He felt that the Indonesians were able to cohere because they had a national ideology called Pancasila. So he wanted to introduce the same idea, hoping that perhaps with a national ideology, the people could come together. And that's how it started. So he formed a committee and we discussed this subject for a long time and finally came up with the Rukun Negara. But the Rukun Negara is now not being popularly spread among the young. In schools, for example, I don't know whether they teach Rukun Negara in the school, but more than just getting the pupils to memorize, they must understand what is keluhuran perlembagaan, constitution. What is a constitution? The young do not know.
At the time, did you feel, you know, the weight of responsibility of coming up with a national ideology?
Well, yes, very much so. Take, for example, the first principle, kepercayaan pada Tuhan. So we discuss, you see. Does that mean that if somebody wants to be an atheist, he will be punished? So we discussed this. And we said, Malayans as a whole, Malaysians as a whole, have religions. Only a small minority may not have. And because of that, they believe in God. So if a handful of Malaysians here and there want to be atheists, it's not a problem. So that's how we decided that the first principle should be kepercayaan pada Tuhan.
How many drafts were there before, you know, there's that final Rukun Negara?
It's only about a year or two.
Out of curiosity, I mean, you mentioned earlier that this is something that needs to be communicated properly. You know, it's not something that can just be recited just memorized. Mm. How would you like to see it communicated within education to the people who are actually saying it every day?
It is easiest if it is done through history. Most people think history is a study of politics. No. History refers to the past, to past everything. So you can discuss the society, you can discuss so many things. And it doesn't have to appear as if you are trying to influence the people to join this religion or that religion. Also, geography and history cannot be divorced. So if the people can understand, the people say in Johor can understand the people in Kelantan, and the people in Kelantan can understand the people in Perak, it would help a lot, because then we become one nation.
Considering we're speaking so close to Malaysia Day, where is your view on the debate of the significance of 1957 and 1963?
57 was confined to Peninsular Malaysia. So the important thing is this. Most people don't realise that Malaysia was formed. Sabah, Sarawak and Peninsular Malaysia together comprise Malaysia. So if you ask Malaysians today about Malaysia, many of them will say 13 states. Wrong. Malaysia is made up of three autonomous territories. So each territory cannot dominate the others. It is very important that the people in these three territories realize that they belong to one another. But not sufficient is being done to get them to know one another. So that is a problem which has to be looked into. Otherwise, we can never predict what will happen, see, when the young grow up and they are influenced by people who want to split the nation.
Merdeka continues to be celebrated with quite a great deal of fanfare. You know, you see the flags, you see the parade and so on. And Malaysia Day is only starting to kind of catch up. What is your take on how significant it is that we continue to have these days of celebration, and that unlike America and the 4th of July, we have kind of both of these days that need equal attention in some ways.
Again, education. The future of the country depends on the young people. If the young misunderstand, the future is very dangerous. But if the young people understand, then we can become better and better.
And finally, what message would you like to leave us with on Malaysia Day?
I think it's very important for them to understand, for the young people to understand their society and their country.
Thank you very much, Professor. I've been speaking today with Professor Emeritus Tan Sri Datuk Khoo Kay Kim, a historian, and we've been discussing the identity of Malaysia in many ways and how it was formed. You've been listening to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.